This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, June 7th, 2005. On May 25th, Amnesty International General Secretary Irene Khan spoke before the Foreign Press Association. She was releasing Amnesty International's 2005 report on human rights around the world, a survey of 149 countries. It revealed a familiar pattern of abuse and impunity in many different situations. But what made headlines and what the press noticed was the statement she made: Guantanamo, the U.S. prison camp in Cuba, has become the gulag of our times, entrenching the notion that people can be tamed without recourse to the law. She said, if Guantanamo evokes images of repression, the ghost detainees or the incommunicado detention of unregistered detainees bring back the practices of disappearances so popular with Latin American dictators in the past. What the United States has done, she said, both the United States, the United Kingdom, and European countries, is set aside an absolute prohibition of torture and ill treatment by redefinition and rendering the transfer of prisoners to regimes that are known to use torture, subcontracting torture. It's a dangerous agenda. Justice is not only denied, it is also distorted. In other words, torture has become commonplace. That the United States, it's a great economic and military superpower, is thumbing its nose at human rights. The United States has created a global gulag. Today on Taking Aim, a United States global gulag and the centrality of torture. Ralph?
Well, Maya, this is a rather astonishingly late discovery. After all, the death squads of Latin America were U.S. Directed operations that the Central Intelligence Agency and Special Forces oversaw. The School of the Americas is the most eloquent illustration of that. But in this Amnesty International report, it notes that the, quote, refusal of the U.S. administration or the U.S. Congress to conduct a full and independent investigation of the generalized use of torture and ill treatment by U.S. officials, despite the evidence collected by Amnesty International and others of practices of this nature in Bagram, Guantanamo, and detention centers under U.S. control, the clear conclusion has to be drawn that torture and the gulag are an aspect that cannot be changed at the moment of U.S. policy. Amnesty International concludes, Guantanamo, as you say, she states, is the gulag of our times, evoking images of ghost state detainees, incommunicado detention of unregistered people, and indeed generalizing the disappearance and the torment and the death of untold numbers of people.
What has happened since the revelations of what was going on at Abu Ghraib is that human rights organization after human rights organization, the American Civil Liberties Union, Amnesty International, Physicians for Human Rights, the Human Rights Watch, and others have been investigating the abrogation of people's rights, but as well, the U.S. military has also conducted investigations, some of which has been kept secret, others of which have been revealed, mostly by people who are secreting, taking the secret documents and exposing them to the press. Still, 36,000 pages of documents and reports of 130 investigations, mostly from the FBI and Army, have been turned over to the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, as a result of its Freedom of Information requests. And on June 3rd, the judge, Alvin Hellerstein, said that 144 pictures and videos can be turned over, although only in edited form, to protect the victims' identities. The Center for Human Rights said that was taking place was a chamber of horrors. Ralph?
Maya, the report by the Physicians for Human Rights, a 130-page detailed report, is a kind of encyclopedia of the normalization of torture and the justifications of torture at and the approval of such at the highest levels of authority, and pinpointed in this document are George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and the and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and all of the generals who are in high authority, from Hood to Pyrrhy to from institution to institution. It is something that has little to do with so-called rogue soldiers or interrogators or guards on the ground. This follows, quote, directly from decisions by the civilian leadership, high-ranking military officers, those in the executive branch, to take the gloves off, to break prisoners by employing techniques of physical and psychological torture, sensory deprivation, prolonged isolation, sleep deprivation, forced nudity, military working dogs, sexual humiliation, mock executions, the constant presence of violence and death towards detainees and their loved ones, family members, including children. In fact, in that regard, Seymour Hersh, in a piece complimentary to this extraordinary report on May 21st, in which he says it's a dreary pattern. The buck always stops with the handful of enlisted Army reservists whose images fill the iconic Abu Ghraib photos with their inappropriate smiles and sadistic posing of the prisoners, but it all starts from the top. And he states, there are calls for an independent investigation, but no official action has been taken. What do I know? I know of the continuing practice of American operatives seizing people around the world, taking them without any legal review to interrogation centers across Asia. I know of young special forces officers whose subordinates are confronted with constant prisoner abuse and torture in secret hearings. What else do I know? I know the decisions were made inside the Pentagon to indefinitely detain prisoners who are accumulating at staging posts and at detention centers across the globe. In my possession is a memo addressed to Donald Rumsfeld, 900 Pakistani boys, 13 to 15 years of age, in custody and under torture. And Hersh, hardly in the front lines of radical thought or revolution or expose, in The Guardian on May 21st, lays it right at the door of those who are in authority and spells out the torture that is so elaborated in the report, Break Them Down. And Break Them Down is nothing but explicit. Maya?
Yes. In Break Them Down, they address particularly psychological torture, which they state that even if it's not as graphic as the images that were at the center of the treatment and interrogation of detainees in U.S. custody in Afghanistan, Guantanamo, and Iraq since 2002, that the psychological methods, this torture, have extremely devastating consequences for the individual subjected to them and can be just as harmful and often more long-lasting than physical torture. And what do they mean by psychological torture? The practices are prevalent, and most of them remain secret. The policies and practices of the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA particularly, are completely shielded from public scrutiny. Let's look at some of the methods that Ralph mentioned. Prolonged isolation. The use of prolonged isolation, there were reports from the U.S.-run Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan from the beginning of the U.S. Invasion of Afghanistan. In 2002, the prisoners there received harsh treatment, isolation and interrogation that later was brought to Iraq and also from Guantanamo. People were held for 23 hours a day in strict solitary confinement in small concrete cells devoid of any light. The use of isolation was even more restrictive at Abu Ghraib. People were left completely naked in totally empty concrete cells in total darkness for days at a time, months at a time, what then became years at a time. Ralph?
In the case of the Tipton 3 in isolation at Guantanamo, the periods of isolation were many months. Conditions in isolation, they state, are very hard. The cells are made of metal. They are extremely hot. The air conditioning was broken. Hot air flooded through. You had to sleep on a metal bunk. You had no mattress, no blanket. You were denied all comforts. You could not talk to anyone. And in the description of the isolation, what becomes clear is that people are subjected to the kind of constant terror with loud noise that is so ear-splitting that their eardrums were being damaged, alternated by strobe lights that were so bright that the irises of the eye and the retinas were damaged. People were prevented from sleeping on a constant basis, and the isolation was causing them to dissociate and to begin to break down psychologically.
Here is an example of sleep deprivation. An inmate was awakened, subjected to an interrogation in a facility known as the Gold Building at Guantanamo, then returned to a different cell. As soon as the guards determined that the inmate had fallen into a deep sleep, he was awakened again for interrogation, after which he would be returned to yet a different cell. This could happen 5 or 6 times during the night. In another instance, the guards would throw stones at the inmate, the prisoner, until every time the prisoner fell asleep. In Abu Ghraib, the prisoners were hooded, draped in a shower curtain, handcuffed to a waist-high rail. A military policeman would slap the detainee on his back and was told to do so because the detainee was being subjected to sleep deprivation. This was reported by the ICRC, the International Committee for the Red Cross. As Ralph mentioned, the playing of loud music, also constant light in cells devoid of windows, are the typical, even today, methods used by the U.S. forces. This was even reported by Major General Taguba and General Fay in their respective reports. They stated over and again there was the pervasive use of sleep deprivation at Abu Ghraib. Ralph?
The isolation has what is called permanent health consequences of what is called psychological torture. It destroys the victim's sense of privacy, intimacy, trust, security, sense of self, and how he or she relates to their surroundings. The short and long-term consequences are so debilitating that the suffering of victims of psychological torture are no longer able to concentrate. They have not just attention deficit disorder, but dissociation that lasts not years, but decades. It is a disintegration of the personality. Even the most, quote, brutal physical means used cannot compare with the long-term effects of the psychological and the refined psychological means of torture through prolonged isolation. In fact, the CIA manual, the 1983 CIA interrogation manual, which is cited in this report, confirms that the goal of psychological torture is to induce a total psychological regression in the subject. Regression is basically a loss of all autonomy, a reversion to primitive early behavioral patterns. The personality traits fall away in reverse chronological order. The inmate begins to lose the capacity to carry out creative activity, to cope with complex situations, to address stress or interpersonal relationships, or any complex behavior requirement.
Ralph, there have been study after study, scientific study of the effects of psychological torture, the psychological methods used in torture, and for instance, on sleep deprivation. The most pronounced impact of total sleep deprivation is cognitive impairment, and this is impairment of memory, learning, logical reasoning, arithmetic skills, complex verbal processing, and decision making. Sleep deprived individuals take longer to respond to any stimuli. There are attention deficits, short term memory loss, speech impairment, and inflexible thinking. It can also result in hypertension and cardiovascular disease. Decreased pain tolerance, which is very important for the physical torture that then accompanies the psychological torture. And this, as noted by the CIA and the Army field manuals, has implications for other types of torture that is used. And that's why sleep restriction is so much a part of the psychological methods that go, the centrality of the methods of torture. Sexual humiliation is also very much in the news. Forced nakedness, intended to create a power differential between detainees and interrogators by stripping the victim of his or her identity, inducing immediate shame, establishing an environment where the threat of sexual and physical assault is always present. What the report shows is that it's not just the threat of sexual and physical assault, and they give examples, which we'll go into, where there actually was sexual assault on the prisoners.
Well, Maya, it's not just the isolated instances. Sexual humiliation was inflicted upon a female detainees of all ages. An elderly woman was made to crawl on her hands and knees as a large officer rode on her and called her an animal. He straddled her and placed ropes in her mouth and across her eyes and rode her like a horse. He told her he liked to have sex with old women. And then he used a stick to insert in her anus. And the particulars of this example of sexual humiliation are much more than humiliation. In the case of the men, there were prison photos that were released, as you know, and with respect to Abu Ghraib, they do not begin to tell the story that is recounted here in Physicians for Human Rights. The sexual behavior of the guards and of the acting on orders from the highest authority not only required the prisoners to simulate sexual behavior, but in fact imposed it, including compelling prisoners to ejaculate into the mouths of other prisoners and to perform every form of sexual act with electric torture and beatings and brutalization accompanying the performance that was compelled.
Ralph, let's return to some of the concrete examples of the reports from the prisoners, documented reports. And some of these reports are done by the Criminal Investigation Command of the United States Army. Mehboob Ahmed was an Afghan citizen, and he was detained between June and November 2003 at various locations in Afghanistan. He was subjected to intimidation with dogs, questioning while naked, threats directed at his family, and sensory deprivation. The sensory deprivation consisted of being forced to wear black, opaque goggles almost continuously for the entire first month of his detention, then forced to wear sound-blocking earphones. In other words, when you eliminate all sense of sound or sight, it becomes nerve-wracking. It breaks the will of the person. Nabib Siddiqui, another Afghan citizen, was detained also at various locations in Afghanistan between July and August 2003. He was subjected to verbal abuse of a sexual nature, humiliation while being photographed while naked, and also sleep deprivation. And he is one of the examples where stones were thrown at him all night. He was forced to roll around. He was doused with cold water and verbally abused. This is day after day. This is not hazing by in a fraternity. This is not humiliation in a schoolyard. This is day after day, abrogation of all sense of what it is to be a human being and to have a personal identity, and to have no idea of when this treatment will ever end.
Well, the report is very specific, consequences of isolation, and they describe the impact on, we're talking now about thousands of people. The impact of the continued isolation in total sensory deprivation include depression, anxiety, breakdown of concentration and memory, hypersensitivity to external stimuli, hallucinations and perceptual distortions, paranoia, and total loss of impulse control, deep emotional disturbance, aggression mobilized in two directions, suicidal and homicidal, withdrawal into the self, a psychotic-like state or psychosis, and then an intermediate condition between these states, a state of total rage, a crossroads from which the inmate moves in one direction and then another, returning to the crossroads, taking yet another path before total breakdown. This is a recounting of the generalized effect on the victims of this isolation, which is called devastation. Even after short confinement in total isolation, the prisoners are reduced to a semi-fatuous condition from which it is next to impossible to arouse them. They become violently insane, some committing suicide, while those who stood the ordeal better were not generally reformed and did not recover sufficient mental activity to be able to restore themselves to normal life.
And part of this, and what often puts the prisoners over the edge, is the threat of execution and mock executions. Time after time, it has been documented by the military itself, which then suppresses the information, as well as interviews conducted by Physicians for Human Rights and the Red Cross, are the mock executions. On May 15, 2003, two Marines in Karbala, Iraq, held a 9mm pistol to the head of a bound detainee while a third Marine took a picture. A similar incident was reported from Taji, Iraq, dated August 2003, which describes an incident in which a lieutenant committed the offense of communicating a threat when he charged his 9mm pistol, positioning it threateningly during an interrogation, and related he would kill if the prisoner didn't provide the appropriate information. "If you don't talk, they will kill you," is what the interrogators told the detainees. And then he pointed to six soldiers standing in a line with their weapons at the ready. The interrogator then placed the head of the detainee in a clearing barrel and fired his pistol near the detainee's head. The detainee became hysterical and thought he was going to be killed. The CID, that's the Criminal Investigation Division, again, of the military, in a memo dated October 1, 2003, has a statement from a soldier who admits that he threatened to have another man shoot and kill the detainee being interrogated in Baghdad, Iraq. The soldier also handed the detainee being interviewed a bullet and told him it would be the bullet that would kill him. He proceeded to make the detainee kneel down, and this is not just one, but many detainees, with their eyes closed and then shot with unloaded but blank bullets. In August 2003, at Camp Red in Baghdad, Iraq, there is described an extreme technique used to make detainees believe that they would be killed or injured if they didn't provide information. One soldier described how he was told that detainees were made to lie down on extremely hot pavement while Bradley fighting vehicles, these are the very large tanks, were backed up onto the sidewalk, and the detainees were made to think that they would be run over He said rather calmly this was done to, quote, spook the detainees. Ralph?
Well, that's the least of it, because what has happened here, as described in the elaborated report, is that the subject prisoners are in total isolation for years. The prisoners suffer total loss of appetite, anxiety, panic, rage, loss of control, paranoia, hallucinations, suicidal ideation, and self-mutilation. And it describes that the attempts to restore them are largely ineffective, and they're when released, they suffer from such a complex of varied psychological flashback and breakdown that their relationships with others are almost irreparably damaged. They fall into complete self-imposed isolation of a psychic kind, where they can't communicate any longer and they no longer can trust, and they are continually revisiting what they have been subjected to and losing contact with their present reality. That's after a release. And another a feature of the treatment of these people is that their children and their spouses have been brought into their presence, have been tortured in front of them, and they have been informed that unless they cooperate, they will be responsible for the death or permanent injury of their children and their wives. And the account of this is specific and particularized in institutions of detention in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in Guantanamo, and in other places.
Ralph, in fact, the deterioration of detainees' mental health at Guantanamo has been confirmed by the military. An Army spokesperson said that in 2003 alone, there were 350 acts of self-harm, 120 what they call hanging gestures. There was a mass suicide attempt where 23 detainees tried to commit suicide in August of 2003. And on March 9th, 2003, in the New York Times, there was confirmed report that there had been 20 suicides among detainees at Guantanamo, and that was early on. That was before the Army, in fact, had said that there had been over 120 hanging attempts. Now, remember, there are no more than 500 people at Guantanamo now, and yet there are 350 acts of self-harm. This will continue. The U.S. officials have said that by mid-2004, up to one quarter of the 500 detainees are kept in isolation, and a new isolation facility, Camp 5, opened in May 2004. It's modeled on the U.S. Supermax prisons, which we documented extensively in our three-part series, Buried Alive, and it is often in the Supermax prisons at here in the U.S. and at Guantanamo, prisoners are near isolation for years on end, and there are 100 isolation units where lights are kept on 24 hours a day at Camp 5. We will now go to station identification, and then we will return with a U.S. Global Gulag, The Centrality of Torture. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, U.S. Global Gulag, the centrality of torture.
Ralph? Maya, on Section 5, Justifying and Facilitating Psychological Torture, on page 72 of this report, there is a very important documentation of the chain of command and its responsibility. The Bush administration and Congress have created a new legal framework to permit torture and coercive interrogation. The steps taken by the administration have focused on classifying detainees who are as no longer entitled to protection of the Geneva Conventions. It is a repudiation of previous U.S. commitments, for, at least on paper, to oppose and to disapprove of torture. John Yoo, Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel, the Department of Justice, sent a specific memorandum to William J. Haynes II, Department of Defense General Counsel, stating that the laws of armed conflict do not protect members who are said to be members of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. A copy of this memo was sent to William H. Taft, the fourth legal advisor to the Department of State, and the memorandum went up to Rumsfeld, who adopted this approach on January 19, 2002, with a memorandum to Richard B. Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in which he instructed General Myers to transmit to competent commanders in every region the following message: that terrorist individuals under the control of the Department of Defense are not entitled to prisoner of war status or the entitlements of the Geneva Convention of 1949, and that all treatment should be guided by what is, quote, consistent with military necessity. The prohibition against torture was set aside. There is a specific chain of command in which the responsibility for not merely sanctioning torture, but giving specific instruction to combat to commanders in every area of U.S. military operation and in all of the secret detention centers of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon to deploy torture and to exclude none of those who are detained from protections against it.
Yes, Ralph, and that is the point of this over and again. This is not a rogue operation. There are not a few rogue soldiers who are conducting this. It is the policy of the U.S. government, and this is the point made by Amnesty International, whatever the limitations of Amnesty International. The point is that it is at the highest levels of state. It's for the president, it is the secretary of defense, it is the secretary of state, it is the cabinet, and it is the corporate world that puts these people into power that is making torture the normal operating, the standard operating procedure, and disappearance, the standard operating procedure of U.S. policy. Complete abrogation of human rights. What we see in prisons across the United States is now the standard operating procedure of prisoners of war, and often they're not even considered prisoners of war. The redefinition as so-called enemy combatants. This was exposed. What we're talking about today are things that we've discussed on prior Taking AIM programs, and particularly there was an important article by Don Van Natta Jr. in the New York Times, March 9th, 2003, questioning terror suspects in a dark and surreal world. Ralph?
Well, in that article, he describes the treatment of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, amongst so many, and the acceptable treatments were, of course, sleep and light deprivation, the withholding of food, all access to water, sunlight, and medical attention. Availability of painkillers was withdrawn for those who had been wounded and shot. The opaque nature of the way interrogations are carried out blur the lines between torture and non-torture. Routine is covering the suspects' heads with black hoods for days at a time, forcing them to stand or kneel in uncomfortable positions. interrogations occur at isolated locations outside the jurisdiction of any civilian authority or inspection. The locations are kept secret. The Central Intelligence Agency has interrogation centers throughout the Middle East and Asia, at Bagram in Afghanistan, in Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, and a secret CIA installation in Thailand where untold numbers of people are located. The suspects are turned over as well to security services in countries that are known to employ torture and are specifically handed over to those who will torture them. The account by Vanatta in the New York Times is that all appropriate measures are employed in interrogation, which centers on the use of torture.
Ralph, all appropriate measures are the statements of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Secretary of State Colin Powell. And what we have seen through the release of the 36,000 documents that now are in the hands of the ACLU and the reports of the ICRC and the reports of the Physicians for Human Rights, which is gathered up via the Internet, the various reports of the Defense Department and the CID and the other defense agencies and the FBI, what we see, what they mean by all appropriate measures are, in fact, the psychological methods of torture, the physical methods of torture, many of which were disclosed in this Don Vanatta piece in 2003.
The secret CIA-centered Bagram remains near a two-story detention center where suspects are held. They are off-limits to all military personnel. The descriptions of life inside came from those detainees who managed to either escape or who were released. The reluctance to describe details of the condition on the part of anyone in authority is because the actual circumstances are beyond description. Colonel King, Roger King, stated that it was legitimate to use lights, noise, vision restriction to alter without warning the times when people were prevented from sleeping to destroy the detainee's sense of time. Sleep deprivation is within our lexicon. Prisoners are watched, moved, manhandled by military police on a constant basis, and the treatment includes, as I mentioned earlier, the bringing of family members in front of them where they are subjected to torture in the presence of the detainee who is held accountable for the fate of their family members.
And Ralph, in the Don Vanatta piece where he's talking about the torture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Abu Zubaydah, the interrogation where, although Abu Zubaydah had been shot during his capture in Pakistan, they refused to give him painkillers, and which was torture in itself. And it also describes what they call the false flag mind game, where they brought Omar al-Farouk, a confidant of Osama bin Laden and one of the senior operatives in Southeast Asia, and they brought him to what looked like a room in the New York City police and fire departments, and it was called a false flag mind game, where the captive is disoriented, isolated, and vulnerable, and it's made to think that's in a different country from where he was. And in fact, he was still at Bagram Air Base, but they had taken him in an airplane and flown him around and then returned back to Afghanistan, complete disorientation. What we have now since 2003 is that this is not the methods used just on a few isolated people, but that this is the prevalent method that is used throughout Guantanamo, throughout Afghanistan, and throughout Iraq, not just at Abu Ghraib, but in prison and detention facility throughout Iraq. Ralph.
Torture, Inc., America's Brutal Prisons. This is a report on Channel 4 of the BBC by Deborah Davies on March 2nd, 2005. Savaged by Dogs, electrocuted with paddle prods, burnt by toxic chemicals, barbaric abuse across the United States, which explains the horrors that are committed in Iraq and across the world. They are just some of the victims of wholesale torture taking place inside the U.S. prison system that we uncovered during a four-month investigation for BBC Channel 4. It is terrible to watch the videos and realize that you are not only seeing torture in action, but you are witnessing young men dying in front of you. The prison guards stand over their captives with electric cattle prods, stun guns, and dogs. The prisoners have been ordered to strip naked. The guards are yelling abuse at them, ordering them to lie on the ground and crawl. Crawl, mother F, crawl. If the prisoner doesn't drop to the ground, the guard kicks him and stomps on their backs. High-pitched screams from one as a dog clamps his teeth onto the leg. Another prisoner has a broken ankle. He can't crawl fast enough. The guards jab stun guns under the buttocks. The jolt of electricity zaps through the naked flesh and genitals. For hours afterwards, the body shakes. Lines of men are slithering across the floor of cell blocks while the guards stand over them shouting, prodding, and kicking. Second by second, their humiliation is captured on a video camera taken by one of the guards. The images of abuse and brutality are horrifyingly familiar. They are exactly the pictures that came from inside Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. They are similar to the images of brutality against Iraqi prisoners carried out by the British. There is a difference. These prisoners are not caught up in a war zone. These are Americans, and the videos come from inside prisons in Texas. These are just some of the victims of wholesale torture, the report on BBC continues, which occur throughout the United States prison system that we uncovered and documented in film during a four-month investigation for Channel 4. These findings are based neither on rumor nor suspicion. They are based on solid evidence and videotapes that we obtained from all over the United States. In many American states, the prison regulations demand that use of force operations must be filmed by guards, and we have obtained copies of these films. The shapes show procedure, and they show the force involved. Each tape provides a shocking insight into the reality of life throughout the U.S. prison system, a reality that sits very uncomfortably with President Bush's pretensions about democracy and a battle against terror. In fact, the Texas episodes outlined above date from 1996, when George W. Bush was state governor. Frank Carlson, one of the lawyers who fought a compensation battle on behalf of the victims, I asked him about Abu Ghraib and U.S. politicians' expressions of astonishment, and he stated, "Are you serious? We do it here every day. They are trained to do it. It's not only over there, it's everywhere here."
Ralph, the photographs, which are truly horrific, are done with the video cameras. In most prisons, any use of force is supposed to be videotaped as a record, and these were handed over in cases of lawsuits to attorneys, and the BBC 4 got copies of those. And in other cases, the sheriffs themselves invited them into the prisons, and one sheriff in Arizona, Joe Arpaio, says he welcomes the TV crews with unfettered access. He is proud of his title as America's toughest sheriff and was willing to reveal what had been shown. In Florida, however, the new warden of a high-security state prison ordered an end to the videoing of use-of-force operations, and it turns out that in this prison, the prison guards used pepper spray very often in fire extinguisher size canisters of pepper spray against the prisoners. And this warden at this high security state prison, who was eliminated the photographing, and which means that there would be no record for prisoners in abuse cases, he is now in charge of all Florida prisons. He was put into that position by Florida's Governor Jeb Bush. Eliminate all documentation. That is the Bush policy.
BBC's reporter states, for every historical tape we collected, we found a more recent one. What you see on the tape is happening daily. It is terrible to watch these videos. You are not only seeing torture in action, you are witnessing young men dying. In one video, a naked man, passive and vacant, is slid out of his cell by prison guards. They strap him to a medieval-looking device called a restraint chair. His hands and feet are shackled. There's a strap across his chest. His head lolls forward. He looks dead. He is not. Not yet. The chair is his punishment, because guard saw him in his cell with a pillowcase on his head. 16 hours later, they release him from the chair. 2 hours after that, he dies from a blood clot resulting from the beatings and his barbaric treatment. The tape comes from Utah. There are multiple others, from Connecticut, from Florida, from Texas, from Arizona, from New Jersey, from New York. We found more than 20 cases of prisoners who died after being held in restraint chairs. Two of the deaths we investigated were in the same county jail in Phoenix, Arizona, run by a man who revels in the title of America's toughest sheriff. He is known as Joe Arpaio. He positively welcomed the TV crews, and we were promised unfettered access. You don't want to be fettered in one of Sheriff Joe's jails. We uncovered videotapes from surveillance cameras just showing how tough his stance is and how it almost invariably ends in tragedy. The first tape shows a man named Charles Axter dragged in by police, handcuffed at wrists and ankles. He is mentally disturbed. Axter is a drug user. The police handed him over to the sheriff's deputies in the jail. He is a tiny man weighing 126 pounds. The tape shows 9 deputies beating him in a restraint chair. One kneels on his stomach, pushing his head forward to his knees, pulling his arms back to strap him into the chair, and bending him double is dangerous because of positional asphyxia. 15 minutes later, Axter is dead. He is brain dead. He died 3 days later in hospital. Axter's family is currently suing Arizona County, and the report goes on. This is a 15-page, single-spaced report. This is but a fragment of it. It describes these conditions and videos of this nature in prison after prison across the United States.
The Channel 4 in Great Britain report by Deborah Davies was one of a series of broadcasts that was the BBC had prepared. Another was a Guantanamo-style torture show. This is the ultimate in reality broadcasting. And it was called the Guantanamo Guidebook. And it recreated some of the practices used at the U.S. Naval Base. And they set up in an East London warehouse, and based upon the declassified internal documents, they mocked up conditions inside Guantanamo, and they had volunteers, 3 of whom were Muslim, and they were subjected to 48 hours, only 48 hours, not the months and months, of what was called torture light, the sleep deprivation, the use of extreme temperatures, and mild physical contact. In other words, they didn't have dogs go and attack them. And this was a series that was done on the use of torture in the supposed war against terror. And this brings us to what is on one of the top series in the United States on TV, on Fox TV, and this is the what is called the acclaimed Fox series 24, which has been on for 4 seasons. It uses a real-time format. It braids storylines. It's very fast-moving. And an article by Adam Green that appeared in the New York Times May 22nd says it's a heady brew of national security and sentimentality, uncommon in its topicality. Ralph?
The article in the New York Times on May 22nd is called Normalizing Torture on 24. The acclaimed Fox series 24 has received its attention for 4 successful seasons, as you say, Maya, and for its uncanny topicality. This is not the first time that torture is featured on this show. It is a portrayal of torture in prime time, the article continues. In season 2, a national security advisor is interrogated with a defibrillator while the president watches on a monitor. The counterterrorism unit agent extracts information from the detainee by forcing him to watch a streaming video of the execution of his child. Later, Jack himself is captured by operatives, cut, burned, and shocked to the point of heart failure. Interrogation in the first three sessions...
Seasons
involved threat of violence to produce information vital to the defeat of an unending number of emergencies. On the present season of 24, the article continues, torture has gone from being an infrequent shock bid to being a main thread of the plot. A half dozen characters have undergone interrogation under conditions that meet any conventional definition of torture. The methods portrayed include chemical injection, electric shock, and old-fashioned bone breaking. Those subject to these treatments have constituted a broad range from an uncooperative associate of plotters to a Middle Eastern wife and son linked to an operative to the teenage son of the current season's Secretary of Defense. In the marriage of political crisis and melodrama that marks 24 as a leader in television's post-9/11 genre of national security thrillers, Jack Bauer, romantically involved with Secretary of Defense Heller's daughter, Audrey, interrogates her estranged husband using the electric cords of a hotel lamp, only to discover that the allegations linking Paul to an unfolding terrorist nuclear plot are false. The prospect for Jack and Audrey's relationship took several turns from the worse, reaching a low with Paul's death after Jack withheld urgently needed medical care.
Ralph, the war protester son of Secretary of Defense Heller, more alienated than ever after a session of sensory deprivation in a holding room of this anti-terror agency, the CTU, receives a strikingly paternal lecture from his father about why the treatment was appropriate. Imagine this. The Secretary of Defense is telling his anti-war protester son why it is appropriate that he has his son tortured. This is the level of society.
Well, it goes beyond that. Recent plot developments demonstrate the following. A striking episode this season, the New York Times article continues, involves torture concerning Joe Prado, a suspected terrorist accomplice, freed just before being interrogated thanks to a lawyer working for Amnesty Global, a barely fictionalized Amnesty International. The ever-resourceful Jack, knowing what has to be done, resigns from CTU and then, in a parked car outside the CTU building, expertly breaks Prado's handcuffed hands to procure vital and accurate leads. An earlier revelation that an anonymous call prompting the lawyer's action comes from a terrorist mastermind underscores the moral of the episode. Regardless of good intentions, those who protect suspects' rights are abetting terrorist activity to catastrophic ends, the New York Times continued.
Ralph, this is reminiscent of Clint Eastwood and the Dirty Harry series, where police officers had to take matters into their own hands.
But the matters they are taking into their hands are specific demonstrations of torture unto death. The question of torture's role on 24... is constant. Very little public scrutiny, much less protest, a violent interrogation is depicted, the New York Times says. Human rights violations take longer than 24 hours to come to light when they do at all. But if the good guys on 24 go about their work, unaccountable to law or to public opinion, they remain obligated within this show's moral order to one another and their continued practice of torture. What is most striking about torture is how it affects not only policies, but emotional and professional relationships. The CTU data technician, Sarah Gavin, is interrogated with tasers to discover if she might be a terrorist mole. And she returns to work without sign of trauma and marshals the clarity of mind to renegotiate her terms of employment with her superior, who approved her torture just hours earlier. The war protester son of Secretary of Defense Heller, more alienated than ever after a session of torture, receives a strikingly paternal lecture from his father about why the torture is appropriate. Audrey's husband, Paul, rises above his grievance to view his erstwhile tormentor as a buddy, helping Jack extract documents from a defense contractor, fending off attacks, and loyally taking a bullet for him. In all of these interactions, torture doesn't deaden feelings between people. Rather, it deepens them. It is noted that torture goes against the tenets of human community because tortures deny basic humanity of their victims. But on this show, torture constitutes the ultimate bonding between both victim and perpetrator. This twist raises questions, the New York Times article continues. It is a problem that descends easy political distinctions, as the capacity to abuse is just as universal as the desire to be free. 24 descends down a slippery slope into portraying acts of torture as normal and justifiable. Is its audience and the public more generally reworking the rules of war to the point where the most expedient response is to resort to torture? In the world beyond the show, the debate remains heated. How it plays out on 24 says a great deal about what sort of society we are in the process of becoming. Here you have the celebration of torture, the romanticization of torture, its explicit sanctioning on a popular television program.
As Irene Kahn, we began the show with the General Secretary of Amnesty International, said on May 25th, you have at the highest levels of state the rewriting the rules of human rights, discrediting the institutions that would foster human rights, usurping the language of justice and freedom to promote policies that create fear and insecurity. As we have said, creating the terrorist state. This has been part one of U.S. Global Gulag, The Centrality of Torture. We will continue next week with part two.
When we will illuminate how the centrality of torture defines both culture and politics and the norm in American society.
This has been Ralph Schoen and Maya Schoen on Taking Aim. Our programs are archived at www.takingaim.info, and you can reach us at takingaim@patbell.net.